Good evening. Welcome everyone to the Civil Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Grant and I'm an alcoholic. Amen. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God. Civil Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use the room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer up a small flight of stairs and a caddy quarter from this room. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterruptedly. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. We're gonna try that again. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. Our preamble, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study, which is our usual format, which we meet here every Monday night at 7 o'clock. We have a little panel up front here, and the chairperson reads a couple paragraphs at a time from the big book, and then we have a panel discussion and we kind of go back and forth. Quarterly, we have supper and a speaker, which is what you're all present for tonight. And we're gonna have a speaker this evening. Our speaker is Merv from Charlottesville. And I'm not really gonna get carried away with any make-believe stories about what he has or hasn't done in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm gonna let him come up here and tell his own real story and see if you can get a little experience, strength, and hope out of it. So if we can all welcome Merv.
Everybody, I'm Merv Lingle. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. These things always give me like stage fright. All you people don't scare me, but these things here always get me kind of weirded out. And before I start, if there's any veterans, active members of on duty, or spouses here tonight, I want to thank you for your sacrifice and your service. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. My grandfather and my father both are veterans. They both were veterans, and they play a large part in my story. And I also sponsor guys who are veterans as well. And if any of you guys are Navy guys, I know exactly what y'all did. So that was meant to be a joke, but I guess not. I'm failing already. Anyways, I've been up since about 4:30 this morning. I managed a coffee shop, and I worked, and then went home, showered up, got in the car, got here, hit every Starbucks on the way. So I might be in the middle of an espresso blackout and might not even remember this tomorrow. So if I say something offensive, I apologize. And so my name is Merv, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Merv.
Okay, and I've said that already, but whenever I got here, they told me I needed three things. And the first thing they told me I needed was a sponsor. And I got a sponsor. I've had the same guy for all but 6 months of my sobriety. They also said you have to get a sober date, and you have to protect that date. And you have to protect that date by taking the actions outlined by the book Alcoholics Anonymous and being involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is June 1st, 2001. And they also said that you had to get a home group. And my first home group was a bunch of hillbillies in Buckingham County for the first year. And then me and my good friend Travis started a home group in Charlottesville, Virginia, that I've been a part of ever since. It's the Common Solution Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Thursday nights at 7:30. And it's a fun group. We're active on all three sides of the triangle. We have a prison commitment. We do a lot for the community, and I'll tell you what, we are a group that plays together, and we always have, and I'm always proud to be a part of that home group. My story, it's not any different. I used to think whenever I came in, it was like a low bottom one. I find out it's probably not that bad, and I'm probably not boring with too many of the details of that. But I will tell you this, it took me 7 years coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for me to become a sponsorable member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say that because I had a sponsor for those 7 years that I was in and out, but never once did I take direction. Never once did I hit a sufficient place where all of a sudden what he was saying sounded like a solution to what I had. And I tell you, alcohol had to answer every question about what I wasn't doing in Alcoholics Anonymous for me to come here in a state where all of a sudden, I was out of answers. Consequences played a big part on me getting here, but I'll tell you what, they don't keep me sober today. Neither is the fear of the first drink. That'll never keep me sober, as you know, the same with self-will and also self-knowledge. All those things I thought were powerful things whenever I came in, but I found out over time and by watching a lot of people take a drink for me that stuff doesn't mean shine all. It's all the actions here. And for me, you know, a long time, you know, I had to kind of think, you know, like, what were my old ideas about alcoholism? I talked to a guy earlier this week, and you know, it was the same thing. You know, he's coming up to me, and he's basically been over a couple of relapses recently, and he kept telling me why he drank. And I was like, wrong answer. You know, girlfriend, wrong answer. You know, I don't know, my job's not good enough, wrong answer. You know, and he was just like, I don't have these things like other people have. I was like, wrong answer. And he's like, well, what's the right answer? And I said, you drank because you're powerless over that first drink. I said, you drink because you suffer from an illness that once you start drinking, you can't control the amount. But the real problem is what happens whenever we stop drinking without an alternate solution. And I'll tell you, you know, that 7 years of in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did more suffering from alcoholism than I ever did from any consequence I ever got. And I'll tell you, just not drinking is not a solution for my problem. And it's a good start. You know, while you're getting your feet up under you, you're going to meetings, you're scouting out a sponsor, not drinking one day at a time. If you can muster that, because you get that free grace of God, that pink cloud for a couple of days, once that surrender flag goes up, but man, you better find somebody quick and you better get ready to take some direction because it ain't going to last forever. And I'll tell you, it didn't last forever for me. My sponsor, whenever I came in, they kept telling me, they were like, hey, every alcoholic has a fuse, you know? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, once you come in, you get this grace from God. And you have a fuse that starts burning immediately until you take your next drink. And I asked him, I said, well, how long is my fuse? And he said, well, you know when you get drunk, you know? And I didn't like that answer, you know, but now it's like, you know, by the time I got here, it was very apparent that I was a short fuse alcoholic, you know? We were having a discussion about small towns before the meeting, and I came from a small town. I came from a small farming community, and you know, I was surrounded by Amish people, and there was like a one-lane town with one light, and it was in a smack dab in the center of Pennsylvania. And I was growing up, and you know, I don't know if we're born with alcoholism or we get it, and I don't get into the debate about all that, but I'll tell you what, I was definitely concerned about what people thought of me long before I took a drink. You know, I suffered from depression and untreated resentment, which is the same thing, long before I took a drink. I was a victim of my circumstances. I was a victim of bad parenting long before I took a drink. You know, and I'll tell you, I was self-centered to the core. And I'll tell you, you know, whenever we start talking about the bondage itself, man, I know what they're talking about. Because, man, I had the pseudo armor up around me, and I'll tell you, nothing was breaking through. Because I was petrified of what you people thought of me, because I was the overweight kid. I had no friends, I grew up in a trailer park, and everybody around me seemed to have a lot more than me. And I was living in my own little reality. And, you know, growing up, I mean, I got a good look at what alcoholism was. Now, Mom threw alcoholism around a lot. She called everybody an alcoholic, and she was right, you know, part of the time. But she called my dad an alcoholic. My dad was one of those guys who kind of looked like us, right? he was one of those guys who always like drank too much. I mean, he'd go out, he'd take me out for a steak dinner, you know, and we'd end up, you know, having to call mom to come pick us up. They were always fighting about, you know, dad's drinking and the trouble he'd get into. And then he quit for a little while, but sooner or later he'd pick back up. But the day came, just like the book describes, where they found a spot on his liver. He just had his first grandchild, and he put the plug in the jug. He even had the DTs for 2 weeks, but then he became happy and sober. He didn't go to the shrink. He didn't go to AA. He didn't go to church. He didn't do nothing, but he became happy and sober and became a useful member of our family. Him and mom even got back together. And for a long time, you know, like, man, I stored that away in my keen alcoholic mind, you know? And then I have my grandfather. And my grandfather is one of those guys that, you know, we go to visit, and it was always like, you know, all bets were off at grandfather's house, right? You know, if God forbid mom and dad would leave, you know, I mean, it was like, I had three older sisters, and I mean, anything went in that house. And I mean, they were drinking peels. I mean, oh my God, you know, but I watched my grandmother drink herself to death, and then my grandfather became, you know, moved in with us. And I mean, this guy, he is the alcoholic. And I'm watching this up close because my grandfather on my dad's side, I met him the day before he died of cirrhosis, right? So now my other grandfather moves in, and my mom's idea of for him to control and enjoy his drinking is for me to go along with him, right? And, you know, thinking that, oh, he won't get too plowed because he has to bring this, like, his grandkid home, right? And I'm like 11 or 12, and I'm living in my own little universe. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, they don't have bars. They have, like, honky-tonks, right? Like, there's no windows, and people are going in 11 a.m., you know. I mean, there's a mirror in there so you don't drink alone, right? And he'd drag me in these things. He'd give me my little 25-cent pack of cashews, and I'd belly up to the bar. And, I mean, you'd look around, and there'd be other people there. And Joanne C., who died shortly after I got sober, man, she was the first person I ever saw who was shaken out, who would have to hold her hand to get that first one down. And I'm looking around, and there are all these people, and they're face down, and it's just like, man, it's like Night of the Living Dead. And I'm like, oh my God, if I ever turn out like one of these people, somebody needs to shoot me. And I'm looking around, and something started to happen, and this happened with such regularity because I was going with my grandfather 3 times a week. After about drink 2 or 3, somebody put a quarter in a jukebox, somebody put a quarter in the pool table, I'd hear somebody laugh, and then all of a sudden the place would come alive. And little did I know, I was witnessing the effect produced by alcohol. You know, after 3 or 4, all of a sudden these people just started to feel human, maybe for the first time that day, which was probably true. You know, and I'm like looking around and I'm seeing this, and I'm just like, oh my God, this is crazy. On my last bender, I'm sitting in that same bar stool that my grandfather did. And the thing is like, my grandfather died the alcoholic death. I mean, there is no doubt about it. And, you know, so growing up, I really didn't want a part of alcohol. I didn't want a part of drinking. I didn't find it like that great. Marijuana and all that stuff was not available. I mean, it's a farm town. I just didn't know the right people. I'm living all alone, and, you know, mom is spending half her time in the mental institution, dad's gone. And, you know, I had to learn how to make mac and cheese. Like, you know, I had to learn how to do that. And for a long time, I would hold that over their heads. You know, I'm a victim of bad parenting and all that type of stuff. But what happened was, is like, my 3 older sisters, 2 of them were at Penn State at the time, the other one was living in Lancaster County. They all got together and they said, Merv, we want to go out tonight. And we're talking about the 80s, right? So everybody was like, had Flock of Seagulls hair and all this stuff was going on. And I went out, and it was like the only bar that actually played music. And I'm like 15 and a half, 16 years old. And I go out with them. And, you know, at this point, I don't want any part of booze. You know, I've just watched all these people die. And it's just like, just not part of my gig, right? And they all get their drinks, and the bartender comes down to me. And she just eyeballs me. She knows better, but she says it. And she says, what are you going to have? And for some reason, I said, I'll take a double Jim Beam and Coke. And we all have that moment, right? We all have that moment where we where we feel the effect of alcohol for the first time. And I'm going to tell you what, man, that was it. Man, all of a sudden, the fear of what other people thought of me, that whole Merv living in isolation, you know, Merv being at home learning how to make mac and cheese by himself, Merv with no friends, all that stuff just kind of washed away. And that night, I laughed, I think, for the first time in my life. I felt like I was part of the human race, and the fear of engaging with other people dissipated enough that I was able to come out and play. And I'll tell you, we hit the bullseye on that first one, man. And I did. Man, I hit that bullseye square in the center. And I'll tell you, man, you know, for the first like couple of years of my drinking, I hit that bullseye every single time. And I think we all have that, because then what's going to happen is over my drinking career, the delusion that I'm even going to get that dart on the wall, let alone the dartboard, you know, it's always going to be there, right? And I'll tell you, man, I had arrived. And what alcohol did for me was it took this overweight, friendless person, and by the time I was a senior in high school, I was voted most likely to succeed. I had the prom queen for a girlfriend, and I was president of my class. That's what alcohol did for me. You know, so, you know, I worry about it. You know, I still hear it. You know, alcohol was my problem. Man, alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was always my solution. It was always my solution. You know, so, you know, they call King Alcohol for a reason, right? King Alcohol wants some sacrifices. I made plenty of them. College education, man, in the name of Merv drinking the way that he wants to drink, man, that was an easy trade. Yeah. You know, all of a sudden I have lines drawn in the sand. I'm never going to do this. But man, I started doing that. You know, I started thieving. I start, you know, doing things with people I shouldn't be doing things with. I start hanging out with people I shouldn't be hanging out with. And I'll tell you, you know, and I would just cross one. I just couldn't lower my standards quick enough for alcohol. If it wanted anything, self, if it wanted my dignity, if it wanted esteem, man, I traded all that stuff in. And it was powerless not to. And that's the whole delusion, you know. I used to think that I was such a bad guy. Maybe I was a bad guy, but the whole thing was in the throes of active alcoholism, man, it doesn't matter what gets in my way, I'm trading it in because I need to drink the way that I want to. Because I am not the guy who can control and enjoy his drinking. I never have been. And, you know, long and short of it is, man, I ended up hopscotching all over the East Coast. At 21, I bought a punk club in Savannah, Georgia. And then I ended up in New York, and I mean everywhere in between. And a lot of it's for the same reason that we always talk about. It's because I was always leaving town on the heels of a disaster, you know? Like I just stole from somebody, or I just slept with somebody's girlfriend, or, you know, I just lost another friend, or I got caught in all my lies, and I just couldn't stand myself because I've just done one of those things that I'm never gonna share with another person. And it's like, man, I need to get out of town and reinvent this personality. And I just moved all over the East Coast. And I turned into a bartender because it was an easy occupation for a guy like me. I'm able to talk, I'm able to chat, I'm able to con. And, you know, the other part of it is too, man, it was like easy access, man. Every bar I ever worked in, there was a liter of Absolute Citron in that ice bin. And that thing would always start there. And if I got to the bottom of it and I was able to stay conscious, man, that was a good shift, you know? And that's just the way my life ran. You know, and I ended up in Charlottesville, Virginia, and at this point in time, man, I got a couple of DUIs under my belt. You know, I'm also like one of those guys that, you know, now I'm starting to think about maybe I should stop drinking because now I know that every time I drink, man, some stupid stuff's happening, and I just don't know what to do with myself. I need a solution. And one day at work, she walked in the door, and I'll tell you what, and it was funny at the time, but man, what I put that woman through wasn't funny after 7 years. Because here I was, you know, I'm in the throes of alcoholism. I mean, just maintaining a couple of like hours sober each day was just unbearable for my mind. Because I needed something to douse that stuff down. Because now I have a whole horror show and that stuff's creeping up my spine. You know, and I just can't stand who I am anymore because I know what I am. You know, I ain't gonna kid around about it, man. I knew exactly who I was. And she comes waltzing in, and she's a beautiful young creature. And the thing is like, she's different. You know, like, I'm used to hanging out with people who hang out and drink like me, right? And here comes a young lady who's a first chair violinist in the UVA Symphony, has a college degree, going back for a master's, works at a law firm. And why she's cocktail waitressing, I don't know. But I'm in love, right? And I can look back on that, and I know why I fell for her. I mean, A, she was an awesome human being. I mean, I loved her. But really, when we're talking about a solution for alcoholism, man, I would look back and, man, I need to fix my three columns in that resentment inventory. Man, and she offered it all up, man. She offered security, self-esteem. Man, she offered, like, you know, financial security. I mean, and then also, too, man, you know, I mean, all our problems always boil down to sex, checks, and self-importance, right? And I'll tell you what, she had all that stuff nailed. So I gravitated towards her, but I already know I'm a loser. So what do? You know, I invite her along. Our first date is down on Smith Mountain Lake. And we're down there, and she's already, like, out water skiing, and all my friends are having a good time. And I already got that one rolling rock, and it's sitting on that picnic table. And I get halfway down, I'm just going to leave it. You know, so every time that she comes in, I'm like, you know, it's the same beer. Oh, my beer's getting warm, because I know that I'm a loser, right? And I know she's a winner. But now it's like, I need to make myself look better than I am. And the only way that I'm going to be able to get over this hump is I need to drink that Jägermeister in that cooler. So I'm leaving that beer on her. I'm downing that Jägermeister. As you know, whenever she's not looking, man, I'm sucking that stuff down. And long story short, I'm on a jet ski, my best friend's behind me, I fall off my jet ski, and he hits me. And as my head bobbed out of the water, I don't remember anything else. I got helicoptered to Roanoke General Hospital, and I came to 2 months later, after a lot of plastic surgery and all that type of stuff. And I came to, and that little lady's sitting next to my bed. And the first thing out of my mouth wasn't, thank you for sitting here. The first thing out of my mouth was, I have to stop drinking. I have to stop. And I mean, she just looked at me and she said, well, whenever you get out of here, there's probably some kind of help you can get. You know, we talk about that invisible line we cross, right? And I don't know, I'm crossing an invisible line, but looking back, I can kind of see the evidence of it, right? And the evidence of me crossing that invisible line was like 2 days out of that hospital with my head in a bandage. And I mean, I'm braced up, my jaw is wired shut, and I'm stealing liquor out of somebody's liquor cabinet because I need a solution. And my basic bedevilment is that I cannot stand how I feel sober. The pain of that is just too great for a guy like me. And the illusion is that somehow, some way, that dart's going to hit the dartboard one more time. This time it's going to be different. This time I'm not gonna end up in jail. This time. But the whole thing is like the same old scenario. I take a couple of drinks on a golf course because I need to feel human, because I haven't had a drink for days. I need to feel human. And then all of a sudden I'm punching out a windshield in a blackout in West Virginia. Again, I have two, you know? And the thing is like, why? I don't understand what's wrong with me at this point. So these consequences, right? They land me at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, I come into my first meeting of AA. Man, I don't know what's going on. I'm sitting in the back. It's a speaker meeting. Don't know what's happening. I mean, somebody's up there talking. I'm in the back. I'm not paying attention. But, I mean, then at the end, you know, everybody got up and they were saying the Lord's Prayer. And I was like, oh, my God, this is a cult, right? I mean, where are they sending me, you know? And, I mean, if this is a cult, man, you can shave my head and give me a bag of pencils, man, I'll sell them, you know? And, but the thing was, I didn't want any part of it, but it was a great introduction because there was a lot of people who put their hand out to me and welcomed me that night. And I couldn't tell you who they were. But I knew somehow that this was going to be at least a safe place. And I used Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 7 years. And that next 7 years, I mean, I'm not kidding around, man, the suffering that I went through of 7 years of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and not doing nothing was horrific. I mean, because, you know, I come in on the heels of the disaster, which is always she's gonna leave, or I'm gonna lose the job, or, you know, or whatever else is coming down the pike, right? And I come in, and then the fuse is on. The fuse is burning. You know, but all of a sudden, you guys are saying stuff about God. Oh, no, I ain't part of that. Or you guys are talking about, you know, the steps. you know, and I hear the fifth step, I'm like, man, no way, you know, let alone paying back the money, right? I ain't paying back nothing. And the thing is, alcohol, I had to answer all those questions, you know? But in the meantime, my surface life is looking good. Bought the house, you know? Got the trophy wife, you know? I got the job, you know? I'm out of the bar scene, now I have an office with the secretary, right? It's all these things that I thought were gonna solve my problem. Because I knew there was something wrong with me whenever I didn't drink, but I got diagnosed with so many emotional illnesses. And they had me on so many programs, but the thing is I don't suffer from an emotional illness. They tried to treat it and it didn't take because I suffer from a spiritual dis-ease of living. And I didn't know that. I thought I suffered from an emotional or mental illness, right? But the underlying current of all that is if I get the house with the picket fence in a nice neighborhood, if I get the trophy wife, if I get the money, man, I'm gonna be okay enough in here. Then I'm gonna be able to step back up to the bar and I'll be able to shut it down at six like I was when I was 17, 18 years old. And I believed that, you know, until I got there and then I realized it was just, you know, I was worse off than I ever was. Now I'm hanging out in AA, which means I ain't drinking. I'm trying not to because she's gonna leave and then the madness is on. I mean, because now it's like, man, there ain't no looking in the mirror no more. Because now I have that whole litany of stuff that I've done in the past. Man, that stuff is going right up my spine. Man, and there ain't, I can't look at myself. And now it's like, you know, even though the heat's off, you know, and I've had that little sense of relief, but now, man, that spring is winding in my gut. Man, there's nothing right with my job. The shine's more off her. And I'll tell you what, nothing's no good no more. And man, I'm about ready to come unglued. I'm thinking about buying a handgun. And that's what it always boils down to. I take a drink, then the drink takes me. And I don't know where I'm gonna end up every time. The Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that we only have two doors to go through here. One is to die the alcoholic death and the other one is live upon a spiritual basis. And the thing is for years in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was looking for door number three. And I'll tell you, I was. And it didn't become apparent that there was only two doors until it became apparent that there was only two doors, you know? And that day came. That day came, I got out of jail two times in 3 days for drunk in public. She's gone. She's had enough, and I will not describe the pain that I put that human through. She had enough, and she was gone. I get out of jail, and something happened. I had plenty of consequences. Man, plenty. You know, I mean, yelling at like hearse drivers because they wouldn't take me with them. You know, I mean, it was crazy. I was nuts. And the thing was, is like, man, whenever I got out of jail, you know, the consequences put me into place, but really what got me was, is I knew it was never going to get any better. That jail that I have a commitment in now, I was walking down that hill and I was walking back up and I hit the first convenience store and I try to get a 22 down and I'm sitting behind that dumpster, man, and I can't get it. I can't keep it down. And for some reason, I don't know if it was just the grace of God or it was all those chinks hitting my armor over the years, but something fell away. And it was like, man, it's never going to get any better. It's never going to get any better. And there was a person that I hated in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we all have them because, you know, they were doing everything I wasn't doing, you know. They were always talking about God and steps and sponsoring and giving of yourself and... Man, I hated this person for 7 years, because they always ended up in a meeting I was in. But they said a thing about a week before I got sober, and it stuck. And maybe I just had enough armor chipped away. But they said you never have to drink again if you do certain things. So whenever the day came that the jig was up, I called that person up after I threw up the last of that 22, and I said, I need to know what those certain things are. And I didn't know this until years after I got sober. But that person was supposed to go to an AA conference and then go on vacation. That person stopped their life, brought me into their home, 12-stepped me, and took me through the first three steps in a week. Gave up their stuff. man, it was the perfect example of what our purpose is here. And our purpose isn't self-gratification. Our purpose is to grow and give of ourselves. A living member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sense of duty to give back what was so freely given to them, to me. They took me in, you know, and the first thing alcoholics get back, I mean, it's not even a day. The first thing we get back is our opinion, and I had a few. And, you know, because they're 12-stepping me right out of the book, right, you know? And I'm like, yeah, once you start drinking, you can't control the amount. And they're like, oh, yeah, you know, smart guy. That's true. But then they started talking about the pain and agony of the untreated alcoholic, the person trying to white-knuckle it, the feelings that even though you've just burned your life to the ground, or why did you pick that drink up? Why'd you pick it up? And I'm like, man, I don't know. And then they started talking about their own experience of the pain threshold so great that they cannot stand how they feel sober, that this time they have to treat it. And they're either going to treat it with a gun in the mouth, or they're going to treat it with a drink. And they always chose a drink. And I was like, holy smokes. I was like, man, that's what I got. And they said, congratulations, you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And you just so happens, Murph, we have a solution for you. It's called the Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called getting a sponsor, but more importantly, being sponsorable. You have to get a home group. You have to get out there and you have to give yourself freely. And I was like, man, I got to do all that. And they were like, yeah, right away. And that's when they said, man, you're a short fuse alcoholic. You got to get to work. And the thing is like, you know, I look back on it, you know, and I love new guys. And this is the worst day of my life. I was like, no, it's not. Not the worst day of your life. Could be the best day of your life. Could be your absolute bestest day ever. If you take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, all that pain and suffering that happened to me, all those consequences and all that, you know, dastardly stuff that I can look in the mirror at that got me to a place where all of a sudden I could say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God I had all of it. And I can say that because I'm free of it. The promises they made me on that first day of sobriety, first day, was, Merv, the horror show that you're walking in here with, it will be your most useful asset. You will be free of that. And they said, they also told me the other thing is that your life is going to change, and it's not your business to know where you're going, because something's going to coddle you and something's going to direct you. All you have to do is just say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous and yes to a sponsor, and it's going to happen with you and for you and to you. But you got to be willing to take some actions. You know, it's like if I want a cookie, right? If I want a cookie. Maybe I want the Serenity cookie or whatever cookie I'm looking for. That means I got to get my butt up off the sofa. I got to take the steps to the cookie jar. And I got to reach my hand in. Every cookie that I get in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it's the 9-step promises, 10-step promises, whatever, it's all based upon the actions that I take here. It's all a byproduct of action. My life out there is a byproduct of my actions inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm glad I can say that, you know, because I have to keep it that simple. Because if I start wrapping my mind around stuff, I mean, oh my God, I've watched way too many people get way too much stuff in AA and then watch them fall right out the door. The job, the kids, religion. They all of a sudden, they get all these gifts, and then all of a sudden that becomes their primary purpose, but really that's not their primary purpose, it's their own self-gratification. And it's terrible to say that. But I've watched too many people, and I've watched almost everybody I got sober with get drunk doing the same thing. So today, you know, it's like I have to keep my focus on the person walking in the door, because left to my own devices, if I'm sitting around meditating on the lint hair on my belly button, man, I'm going to tell you what, that's doing me no good. What I need to be doing is I need to be walking with purpose with those prayers and put them into action. You know, the book tells me that the only way I'm going to survive certain low spots and trials ahead is through enlarging and perfecting my spiritual growth through self-sacrifice and working for others. That doesn't mean I get to stay at home and meditate all day. That means that I can do that to get myself clear enough to go out and be part of God's universe and help take care of God's kids. That's my purpose, and it makes it real easy. So the steps were fun. Not really, you know, and I mean, I was like, oh God, man, I get myself too. Like, you know, like I sponsor guys, man, wherever I get myself, man, no, they piss me off, you know, and they do. Because, man, I was defiant. Like, I was just like, what's this, turning my will and my life over to the care of God? I'm not turning my will and my life over to God. And they're like, man, that's not what it's telling you. Let me make this easy for you. You know, if you have come to believe that God can take away this insanity, that need to take the first drink, how did you get that? And I was like, I don't know. I guess I watched other people do that. He's like, you're right. We get hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what the fellowship delivers. Hope stands for hearing other people's experience. And if you stay here and your ears are unclogged long enough, you just might get some. And I did. Because I watched people and I heard their stories, but then I saw who they were and they just didn't match up. So I was like, what's this decision about? And they're like, Merv, let's just make it easy for you. If you're going to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, just think about it as you're thinking in your actions. And then all you have to do is just make a decision to go through with the rest of the steps, and that will change you. Because you can't fix what's wrong with what's wrong. And he's talking about my head, right? He's like, the actions will take care of all this. So I went through, you know, and I'll tell you what, all I had to do was just give it my best shot. That's what they told me, and that's what I did. You know, I went through, and the fourth step told me I was a problem. You know, I was full of fear. I was a liar, cheat, and a thief, and I was the most inconsiderate person that I knew. And I got enough out of that I was able to mosey on through with the rest of the steps, right? I think whenever I got to the fifth step and I became crystal clear on every deep cranny that I had in my past, there was a certain freedom in that. But he said, Mer, whenever you go out again, you're going to be amazed at how God's going to put people in your path. And he did. You know, I was this guy, right? And I'll just say this. I used to tell this story, not that one, I guess. You know, in sobriety, right? You know, I wish I could stand up here and tell you I was perfect, but whoa, I am a poster boy for imperfection in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when we talk about character defects, I'm the guy, sometimes I got to run them into the ground until I become humble enough that I'm willing to change. I have to get so uncomfortable with who I am in sobriety that, man, I'm going to tell you what, all right, God, I'm ready to change now. Please take this from me. Show me what I can do. And generally what happens is if I get my butt off of the sofa and I walk to the cookie I find is a new guy. And then that gets my attention off of myself long enough, and then all of a sudden I see myself in him, and then I change. I don't think my character defects go away. I mean, I think I brought them all here tonight, but a lot of them are in remission, right? And the thing is my story goes like this. You know, I was like early in sobriety, I'm like losing my mind. I have a son on the way. It's like my year and a half sober. I got in a relationship early, you know, the whole 9 years. All that stuff we're not supposed to do, right? And I'm losing my mind. And, you know, I got some stuff going on. And you know, a lot of my thing is like, man, I had my heels dug in on my amends, right? And isn't it funny, like the amends that I, you know, for me, like that I didn't want to make were like around money. And then, but yet I suffer from all this fear of financial insecurity over here, right? It's like this fear has not gone away, but I haven't made the amends yet. So I'm living in this, right? And as the story goes, you know, I'm at work. I go from like a law firm, making a lot of money, and now I'm washing dishes at a Greek diner. You know, I talk about humility. There it is. And then they were going to fire me as a dishwasher because it wasn't very good. And they're like, you know, and the Greek, I love this guy. He was like, you can wait tables. And I was like, yes, I can wait tables. So I'm waiting tables. And, you know, and I don't think I'm deserve enough. You know, he's taking advantage of me, you know, and all this stuff. When I should just be grateful I got a job, man, you know. And so I start stealing baklava from this Greek diner, right? They won't miss a piece of baklava. So every day I'm like eating a piece of baklava. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like one day I'm just like, man, I'm stealing baklava every day. And I tell my sponsor about it. He's just like, ha ha ha. And he's like, you got to go back to your girlfriend and find out if she's going to let you pay that back. And I go to her and I'm like, I might lose my job because Greeks only know love and rage. He might fire me for admitting that I steal baklava, you know. And she's like, oh no, you gotta go back and pay that back. I don't want a drunk boyfriend. And I was like, okay. And so I go back and he's just like looking at me weird. He's like, you know, and I pay him for the baklava, right? And, you know, and it was just kind of weird, right? And then I steal some more, and then I go back and I pay for him again. He calls me Malaka, and and then I stop stealing baklava. So I, you know, for me, I ran into ground, but I let the process take over, and now like it changed me, right? And I used to tell this story because it always get the laugh in the meetings and stuff like that. But the thing is God's going to put people in our way, and he put a person in my way that day. There was a guy that comes up to me after the meeting, he taps me on the shoulder, he's like, hey man, I got to talk to you. In case you haven't noticed, I'm the guy who's not laughing at your stupid baklava story. And I'm like, okay. He's like, I'm 7 years sober, and I'm stealing from work, and I have been for 7 years, and I don't know what to do with that. I was like, oh, you know. So whatever we're coming in here with, or even more importantly, the stuff that we fall short on in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's always going to be useful. It always is. It's just up to us to be clear, to be ready to be able to share that. And that's what my sponsor always tells me. The amends, you know, I mean, most of my amends were pretty easy peasy, right? I mean, paying back for stolen porn and all that nickel and dime stuff, easy peasy. But then I had to go back. It was my first Christmas in sobriety. You know, and I'm like telling my sponsor, I'm like, I got a fistful of cash to go to all the places that I stole from. And he's like, hold on there, cowboy. And he's like, who's all going to be home? And I said, mom, dad, sisters, everybody's going to be home because, you know, they're just probably happy I'm living. And I'm coming home. I mean, I never showed up for nothing, you know, and Merv's coming home. So they're all going to be home. And he's like, I think you need to go up there and be a son and be a brother. And if you can't, and they're comfortable, you can pull them aside and you make your amends. I mean, my three older sisters were easy peasy, right? I mean, they were just like, just don't die and keep doing what you're doing, right? And I'm like, you know, going through the whole elaborate amends like approach and, you know, how else may have I harmed you? And they're like, just don't die, you know? My dad doesn't really want to hear it, but my dad came up and he hugged me. And he said, I'm proud of you and I love you. And that's all I've ever wanted to hear. And he's told me so many times, but I think I heard it that day. Because, man, I look back at me and my father. You know, I mean, I was never, I used, isn't it amazing how Alcoholics Anonymous can go back and rewrite your past for you? Yes. Like it did. Alcoholics Anonymous went back and rewrote my past. I mean, growing up, you know, I was like a victim of like blah, 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 you know, and dad was never around. I used to be abusive. They were never abusive, man. I used to make stuff up in my head. Then I'd say it so many times I believe it, right? But now it's like, man, you know, and it was tough because my dad, he never wanted to ask for help because he was a proud guy. I mean, you know, I always wanted to be my dad. He was a grease monkey, right? He always had grease up his arms. He was always fixing stuff, you know? And he was like, I mean, he'd take me on his corny fishing trips. And I look back and those were like the best things, you know? And never gave him a sense of appreciation. All I did was ever basically just turn my back on him because he never gave enough, right? The day came, and I was still drinking at this point, where a tree fell on my mom and dad's trailer. And it was the first time they called for help because at this point I'm working in a law firm and I have money. And I'm just not drinking in the middle of AA. Right? I'm not sober yet. But man, I'm going, but now he needs help and I'm choked up because now the truth is I've always wanted to be a good kid. I've always wanted to be a good son to that man. And I couldn't get across the state line. Couldn't get across the state line. It took me 2.5 days to make a 4.5 hour drive. And whenever I got there, I was so in the middle of a binge that all I could do was cry. There was no help, and I had no money left to give him. I mean, a pathetic excuse for a son. There was my golden chance. So whenever I went back and I made amends to my dad, and he told me that he was proud of me and he loved me, man, something happened. Something happened. The years of whatever between this man and evaporated on that spot, you know, and that's just as big of a thing as removing alcohol is for a guy like me. Now, my mom, on the other hand, I was scared to death to make my amends. I make my approach to her, and I don't want to do it. I have an hour and a half to go before I leave to come back to Pennsylvania, and or leave to come back to Virginia, and I don't want to do it, but I know I got to do it. And so finally, I corner her off, and we sit down. And I'm like, Mom, you know, just in a general way, I'm like, man, I was kind of like a scumbag kid. You know, like when you fell down the stairs and how that went down, you know, stuff like that. And she's like, no, Murph, if I would have raised you better, you would have turned out better. How many years did I tell her that? I told her that so much she believed it herself. We get the cookie here. We make these amends. We get those 9-step promises. More importantly, we get the 10-step promises. But man, I'm going to tell you, I don't know how much Alcoholics Anonymous is just here for the alcoholics. You know, sometimes I wonder if God's biggest trick was not to give us this program, not to save us, but to save the people around us from us. Because whenever I sat across the table, we made amends, and I looked at her square in the eye, I said, no, Mom, you did the best you could with what you had. That's bull crap. I told you that for a long time. You are a good mother. You've always done more than your share to raise me. You showed me the way of values. You showed me the way of principles, and I turned my back on you every time. Something happened after that 20-minute discussion between us. She changed. She got free, and so did I. But man, she changed that day. And thank God she did. You know? Man, how selfish of me to pin that on her. But she was free that day. So Alcoholics Anonymous can rewrite her past. Now I look back, it's not the same past I came in here with. There were beautiful people who did everything they could for me. I was just a lousy kid who couldn't show up, and I was too selfish to even engage with them because I was too embarrassed to be around them. But I'm not that guy now. And I'll tell you, thank God for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm going to tell you, you're standing here long enough, man, just keep watching, because somebody's already going through or just has gone through something that's going to happen to you. And that was my experience. I watched my friend Alex D. from Richmond lose his dad, and I watched him, how he walked through that with grace and dignity, and how he was able to be a caring and still yet active member of Alcoholics Anonymous during that whole thing. And how it carried him through, because he was in Charlottesville, he was coming to our home group, and I was hanging out with him, and I watched him up close. So when the day came when my father, I got the call. I'm now power of attorney over my dad, and I just got through a Christmas, and it's like, you know, a couple of days before New Year's, and I get the call. And I'm driving to Pennsylvania. And I mean, I just don't know what's gonna happen. And then the phone rings, and it's Alex D. He's sharing his experience, and he just wants to know, and he didn't want to pat me on the tush, because those people who pat you on the tush will kill you. He said, what are you gonna do when we get to Pennsylvania? I said, I'm gonna go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's like, good boy. Then the next phone call comes, and it's my sponsor. He's like, hey, I've been through this. How you feeling? How you doing? What's the first thing you're going to do whenever you get to Pennsylvania? I said, I'm going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's like, that's good. So whenever I got there, they told me that me being a son means just as much when they pass as it does when they're alive. So when the order came down and I had to give the order to the doctor to pull the plug for his own benefit, I did it because I knew that that was his wishes. And I knew it. I knew I needed to do it because that's what a good son would do for a person that he loves. I used to talk to my dad every Monday. And there was a lot of tough Mondays. But what would happen would be the phone would always ring. And it'd be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who heard me tell that story. So I'm grateful for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because sometimes, man, we have this delusion that God can carry us through, and he does. But the thing is, I need his soldiers, the people I'm walking shoulder to shoulder with, to hold me up sometimes and keep me moving forward. And the direction they always need to put me towards is not Merv concentrating on himself, but outward reaching. Because my problem today is still self-absorption. My problem today is still over-focus on how Murph feels, what he thinks and believes. The solution is never that. The solution is always outreaching to another and getting out of self by self-sacrifice and working for others. It's always the solution. I do a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't do that because I don't want anybody putting me on a pedestal, because, like I said, I'm imperfect. I told all the guys I sponsor, man, I'm walking right here with you, man, because I don't have it down. I still mess up. I still come up short. Sometimes, you know, I wonder what's going on in my life. You know, I have moments like where I'm puzzled. I'm still can be a baffled lot. Early in sobriety, you know, I would call my sponsor and I'd be like, hey, I got a problem, you know. And he'd be like, all right, what is it? And I'd be like, it's her, you know. And he'd be like, all right, this sounds very important. So what I want you to do is I want you to go to 5-6 meetings this week. I want you to get there early, help set up some chairs, share if you want, stay a little bit late, give somebody a ride home, up the prayer and meditation, and then call me back next week. So then I call him back. He'd be like, hey, how's that problem with her? And I'd be like, oh, that's fine. But I got a new problem, it's a job. He'd be like, oh, this sounds important. What I want you to do is I want you to go to 6 meetings a week. I want you to get there early. I want you to help set up chairs, share if you want, offer to give somebody a ride home, talk to some other alcoholics, up your prayer and meditation. Well, like, I'm 5 years sober and he's still doing this to me. And then, like, one day I'm like, oh, okay, all right, yeah. I'm slow, right? But at the end of the day, my alcoholism will always want to pin it. I mean, it wants to pin something on somebody, an institution, a place, or a principle. Always wants to pin my problem, you know. And that's like, you know, for me, you know, it's like I can still fall in that trap. I have a relationship problem. I have a money problem. They didn't build that statue of Merv in the middle of AA town hall problem, right? Self-importance. Sex, checks, and self-importance will still make me believe, my alcoholism will make me believe that that's my problem, and it's never my problem. Like coming in, going to the meetings, outreaching to others, you will hear a loud noise from the like northeast, and it'll be Merv's head popping out of his butt, right? With the realization that I suffer from a spiritual illness. I don't suffer from a lack of whatever my third column needs for me to feel okay, right? And that's why consistency in Alcoholics Anonymous, consistency with my home group, consistency in my commitments are all important. I'll share a quick story and then I'm going to shut it down. When my son was about 4 or 5 years old, right, he's in a preschool. And it's like one of those hippie schools, like Waldorf, right? And which was kind of cool. I got to make little yarn dolls, you know? I mean, he would do these like little half days and I'd go with him because it was like the cool father thing to do, right? So I'd be there, you know, and it's like, it's this time of year, right? I mean, it's fall time. And, you know, and we live, like me, him, and his mom, we live in this place, but all these trees are poplars, right? Sort of like this ugly yellow color. And meanwhile, the field over here and the house over here, man, they have these big red maples, I mean, Japanese maples, everything's like beautiful, and we're in the middle of this like ugly yellow poplar thing, right? So I don't tell my sponsor or the girlfriend, but I go out and I buy a chainsaw and a couple of blades, and I'm like, man, these trees are coming down. They're coming down. And so, you know, and I'm like, so I take him to school and I'm like thinking to myself, I'm like, hey, I'll take the long way around. I'll play some Dark Star because that'll put him to sleep. The Grateful Dead always do. And whenever he comes home, I'll put him in bed and then I'm going to break out those chainsaws and I'm going to do some damage. And, you know, so we're taking the back way around and oh my God, it's like God's watercolors. I mean, the mountains are pristine and everybody's property is all like super awesome, super spectacular. Look back, he's passed out, and I'm like, all right, you know. And I look over the field, and in the middle of this field looks like what is a bouquet of flowers. And I'm like, God, that's like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Well, by the time I get to my entrance to go down the lane to the house, I realize that I live in the middle of that bouquet of flowers. And the thing is, it's like I'm laughing to myself, and I'm like, huh. And isn't that the story of Merv's sobriety? Man, if I'm up close and I'm looking at it too hard, man, it's never good. Merv thinks about Merv, I don't spiral up, you know? I mean, and that's the truth. Man, the things around me always look like it's the pit of hell. But what Alcoholics Anonymous does is it gives me a different direction. It gives me a new attitude. And then whenever I take that new direction around, I always find out that I'm in the middle of exactly where I'm supposed to be at the right moment of where I'm supposed to be. And if I don't concentrate on too hard and I just let it be, it's going to be the most beautiful thing in the world. That's why sometimes, you know, man, I got to go to meetings when I don't want to. I got to get in the car when I don't want to. I got to pick up and call him back, even though I know he's going to tell me his flat tire story one more time. I got to do that stuff because I need all the getting out of me. I need all the self-forgetting I can get. And the only way I can do that is through helping God's kids and being part of God's community, which for me is Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for your time tonight. I want to thank the committee for inviting me down. And I also want to thank everybody who came up and talked to me. I love you all.
All right, Brad.
Thank you, Murray. That was fantastic. I'm like blown away. I don't know about anybody else, so I'm just going to try and get back to the script because that's the only way I'm going to get through this. So we have a seventh tradition, which states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites us all, unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Are there any AA announcements this evening? Thanks, Vince. Any other announcements?
Alcoholic David. Two things. We'll appreciate your help breaking down. We're going to leave six tables when we're done. All the other tables will go up and we'll stack the chairs. Six tables get left with seven around them. And after we do that, you have time to get to the ocean front to hear Amy Kitchen talk at, there she is. She's going to tell her story at 9 o'clock at the last call?
Yeah.
Last call at the oceanfront. So, yeah. If you're not done partying.
Thank you, David. Any other announcements? All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Will all home group members please raise their hand? Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to get your first name so that we might welcome you. Back. Hey, Rod. Welcome. How are you?
Valerie.
Hey, Valerie. Welcome. Two? No more? Hey, Casey. Welcome. Please see me or any of our home group members if you'd like to purchase any of the books that are bound over there. Otherwise, if you can fold it, you can put it in your pocket and take it home with you. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have any questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this podium after the meeting, so feel free to come up and talk to me. I won't bite, I promise. Just a reminder,
Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, can we just get another round of applause from her? After we clean up, please hang around a little bit and get to know each other a little bit better if you didn't get a chance to beforehand. Normally, our format is that after the meeting, we all meet at Plaza del Sol down the street and have a little fellowship and food. So if you come next week, that'll be our gathering place after the meeting. I've asked a friend, Iran, to come up and read the last two paragraphs on page 164.
Ooh, let's go. Where are we going?
Hi, my name is Aaron Marilla-Kolick. Thank you so much for your story. I appreciate it. All right. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come. If your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
So now we'll round up and do the Lord's Prayer. All who would like to afterwards, just come on up and please thank our speaker one more time.
Father.